Hello, hello, Tom.
Hello.
Tom, Steve Blacknell in what's left of England. Hello.
Fantastic. How are you doing?
That's been a while. By gosh. How have you been over the last 30 odd years?
Well, I've forgotten most of it already, but in the last few months, I've been kind of stranded by good fortune in New Zealand because I came here around Christmas time, just before Christmas, as I always do, to avoid the winter in France where I live, and ended up being locked down, of course, so we can't travel very easily from here. But it's not the worst place to be, so here I am sitting by a log fire, midwinter in New Zealand, and talking to you, which is amazing.
A log fire. We're just going through 90-degree heat here, and just a very good old English summertime, you know. But anyway, so let's just backtrack. The last time I would have seen you, gosh, I bought a young lady who is now my wife. We were living, you had a party, and we were living in, I can't think, all right, East London somewhere, I'm trying to think. You had a big party, the Thompson Twins party, and it was in a big house. I mean, it must have been about 1984 or something, and that's the last time I saw you, I can recall.
Wow. Oh, you mean it was out of town somewhere, and there was a place called Stocks that we had some big, ridiculous party in. Maybe that was it.
Yeah. Maybe that was it, but it's a long time ago. So let's just think, crikey, Thompson Twins. When did all that finish for you and the band?
It never really finished on a certain day. It just kind of moved from one thing to another, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The form of the band that most people remember is the three-piece with Alana and Joe and myself, and Joe eventually left, and so Alana and I carried on for a while, but then we mutated into another group because we kind of got a little bit not at all bored with pop music as the only thing we're doing, but we'd forgotten how to do the experimental stuff that led us to our careers in the first place, you know? So we decided to give the Thompsons a rest and become another band for a while. And then we moved to New Zealand. The band was called Babble.
Yeah.
And it was signed to signed in America to Warner Brothers. And it was all, it was a kind of slightly strange thing to do. Everyone thought we were crazy. I suppose we were. But it was like killing a successful career midstream in order to do something very underground. And I suppose they thought, we'll just do that for a year and then come back. But we never did.
But you never did. But I suppose at the height, I mean, obviously it was a global brand, but the height, or here in the States and stuff, I suppose you would have had an audience that you could mess around with. I mean, did you find that a lot of the audience came with you or said, hang on, we want Doctor, what are they up to?
There's a degree of that, and it still exists because, you know, just to rewind or wind forwards to the present, I do quite a lot of concerts these days playing the Thompson Twins music. And, you know, you can only push an audience so far that wants to hear the hits, you know. So I reckon once you've ticked a few boxes, you can take some risks, and particularly you can do kind of interesting new interpretations of old things. But in general, if you just say, oh, I'm going to just play songs that I wrote last week, you see a queue forming at the bar in the distance.
Exactly. Yeah, well, that is true. One great moment I remember working with you, because if you recall, I was sort of your pet interviewer at some point. I mean, when you needed someone to chat to, it was me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, as well as being a fan, as well as being on the box. But I do remember one we did, a Sight and Sound in concert for the BBC, and it was at a time when you're at your height, and they were still recording when the audience demanded an encore. And I recall that you beckoned an engineer on the stage so you could turn the tapes back so you could play the first track again. So it was a day, obviously, when there was not a full band. It was all tape, was effects and stuff, wasn't it? It was a very different world.
Maybe. Well, it's just that in those days, that was the kind of cutting edge thing to do.
Yeah.
Was to use pre-recorded sound effects and what have you. And of course, that means that if you're going to do that properly, you're working to a click so that you stay in time with the effects arrive at the right moment. Which means that everyone's listening to, well, the drummer's listening to the click, and then everyone's listening intently to the drummer so that they're in time with whatever he or she is playing, and so on and so forth. And essentially, we still do that today. You know, I don't know if people notice when they're watching their pop stars on stage, they're all got in-ear monitors. They've all got these things in their ears which are telling them what's going on with the timing of everything.
Yeah, so nothing's changed there.
But I think we were amongst the earliest to kind of adopt that idea.
I just recall shouting out to the audience, "Hang on, they're winding the tapes back," and I just so we could do whatever the track was, the first one again, you know. But it was wonderful days. And so Joe, do you know where he's gone? Where he's finished up?
Well, he lives in Southern California, and he moved out of the music business and does neuro-linguistic programming, which is a kind of transformational process that they're very big on out in California, and that's his gig. And he says it's very, I mean, he does these rather large seminar meetings, and he says it's very much like being on stage with a band, you know.
Well, actually, a couple of years ago, well, about 10 years ago, there was a poll about famous people from Dartford. Joe was from Dartford. The front two were Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Then came Brian Kant from Playaway. Then came Joe Leeway, and I think I was eighth because I come from Dartford. But
do you really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Dartford. And Alana, she's still going strong somewhere.
She is. She's in London, I think, at the moment, and she also comes to New Zealand from time to time because she's got a lot of connections here.
So
at the moment, obviously, no one can travel so easily, but I think that's her plan in the long run, is to come and spend more time here.
Good. So you're active with your band. I see you're touring next year with Human League. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it's a strange world, isn't it? We've announced a tour a year and a half away, and tickets are selling.
That's ridiculous.
Whereas if we announced a gig in 2 weeks' time, no one would dare buy a ticket.
That's ridiculous. Because you work with Culture Club as well, and so you find that quite easy still doing the 80s things?
Yeah, it's not only easy, but it's amazing because there's still a big audience for it. And we did a couple of years ago a big tour around the world, but mostly in America and Australia and stuff. And I think I did over 90 concerts. And I never worked that hard back in the 80s, you know, so it's definitely still a very, very happening thing. You know, I mean, hopefully there's a bit of the wisdom of ages kicked in as well. So you pace yourself a bit more carefully these days. But
One hopes. But I mean, what's your music? How do you describe what you're doing now as opposed to then? You know, are you still babbling? Are you experimenting?
Well, I do all sorts of things. I mean, I've got several different projects on the go at any given time, and I kind of rock between them. When I'm doing the Thompson show, it's pretty much the Thompson's hits plus a few solo songs that I've written. But, you know, for example, here in New Zealand, I'll be doing two festivals where I'm an electronic dub act, and no one knows that I'm in the Thompson Twins.
Excellent.
And I have a classical Indian group that I make records with. You know, things like that. One of the rewards of some kind of limited success in the music business is to be able to pursue your labors of love, you know, and not feel that you're just chasing a buck all the time. And I know that's kind of a strange thing to say when it's becoming so difficult for musicians to survive at the moment. But I'm very, very lucky. You know, I've had that opportunity. It's played out well for me. And I like to keep my fingers in several different pies musically.
Well, it sounds like you are. Just imagine then you're on stage at the Sight and Sound or whatever, you're doing all the hits, Hold Me Now and that, and you're doing, in America, huge business. Back then, could you ever have foreseen that you'd be doing the classical Indian group, or did you think at the time, I'll just always be a pop star? Can you recall?
No, it was totally the other way around. I was already interested in all those things, but wondering why I was being a pop star.
Really?
Yes, and in fact, I always managed to sneak a few of those classical ideas or Indian ideas, and certainly experimental electronic ideas into the pop tunes. But as time went by, I wanted to be able to give more time to them, and never could, you know, because being in a successful pop group is very, very time consuming. So, you know, when the time became available, I've definitely given a lot more attention to those things. And it's really, really satisfying creatively, you know, because you put them aside for so long, it becomes frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, the 80s were an extravagant time, weren't they, as far as fashion and the whole thing, of which I was a particular victim of it too. They were odd times, you know, weren't they? It was a very specific thing. And one thing that is weird about the 80s, which I can't quite work out, you and I have not met in 34 whatever years, you know, and I'm talking to similar people like Junior and other people from the 80s, you know, Tony Adley and people. So, and it just feels like for some reason we went through something. I've never figured out what it was. And why we feel this connection?
Well, I think that's probably true to some extent of whatever era people are in when they're coming of age, when they're teenagers moving into adulthood, and when they're doing all those things that define their autonomy and freedom. So the first time you stay out all night, the first time you have a kiss and a cuddle with someone, the first time you perhaps have something more to drink than you should have had, whatever music is playing at that moment becomes fixed in your identity, and the people of the same age share that musical canon. So I think that's what it is. It's like the coming of age, and we forget how incredibly important that is. And of course, if you think about it, like if you stand back from it and look at rock and roll, it's all about that teenage rebellion becoming adult. And what it means to finally get your hands on the wheel of life, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, I've never quite thought of it like that. So like you, we're around the same age, and I had a bit of the 60s, definitely the 70s, which sort of passed me by, but the 80s seemed to be that point in time, I guess, for me as well as you. So that accounts for it. I hadn't actually thought of it like that, if I'm honest, but you're right. It's the time of the day. That's what music does, doesn't it?
It does. But having said that, I do think that in terms of pop music, the 80s was a bit of a golden age as well. You know, there was so much kind of inventive creativity going on, and amazing. And I mean, you can just listen to 80s music all day and not really find a bad one.
That's what I think. I mean, then I think I tried to get you for the first Top of the Pops book. I did the first one in 84, I think, and then I did the other history. But looking at the music, they say the music stopped when Top of the Pops stopped in 96. It stopped, and perhaps things have got a bit all over the place since. I mean, what do you think of what goes on now? I mean, the music of the day.
Well, it's something I've initially found difficult to understand, but you know, another one of my experiments is writing with other people, helping other people to write. And so I hooked up recently here with a couple of people who write in what I call a millennial pop style, which is very different from the kind of way of structuring a song that I would have approached. But I, you know, by helping them, I've also learned a lot myself about the kind of really the economy of a short attention span. You know, kids these days don't want a long intro and a build up and an atmosphere. They want to start with the chorus.
Yeah.
And so it means that you've got to be more direct in your writing. And so to me, that's fascinating. I may not necessarily believe where it's coming from so much as when I listen to previous works, but I mean, that's another thing, in a sense, that, you know, rock and roll can't go on forever. It has to peak and
wane. Well, then what?
And so, something else will take its place. I think because for a long time it was the vehicle of rebellion, the necessary vehicle of rebellion. But now it's the internet, isn't it? So that's kind of taken over.
It's changed. And
the other thing is that rock and roll for so many years was kind of uncontrollable. It was uncontained. But now it's kind of been, it's been bought a little bit by corporate marketing.
And, well, it has.
It's, it's not free to kind of wave its fist in the air like it used to do.
Well, we're all waiting for the next big thing. There was 60s pop, there was flower power, then came glitter, then came punk, then came yourself and me in the new romantic thing. And then after that, it seemed to be a mishmash. So I guess we're still waiting for the next interview on the Bill Grundy show. We're waiting for the next big thing.
We might have to wait a long time, but you know, things, all interesting things always come along. And honestly, I hear things that really amaze me all the time. So that's not the problem. It's how it's sold around the world, and the fact that it's kind of become a little bit of a charade. It's the clothes and the video seems to have taken over the message somewhat, I think.
Yes, it has.
So anyway.
Yes, but when you think about bands like Duran, and I don't know about Thompson's, but I know Duran were actually writing the storyboard of a video back then and then composing the tune to it.
Right.
So who knows what's coming next. Tom Bailey, Tom, fantastic to talk to you again. Hopefully when you get back, well, perhaps we'll see you in 21 on tour, and lots of love, and be safe there. Yeah,
thanks a lot, and the same to you, and I'm looking forward to seeing everyone in the UK.
Bless you, Tom. Take care.
Bye now.